It is Friday, July the 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a gunman attacks members of the U.S. military.
We have to make sure that we have all the information necessary to make an assessment in terms of how this attack took place and what further precautions we can take in the future.
Also ahead, money for Greece's ailing economy, plus U.S. conservatives criticizing the Pope's view of the global economy. Hello, everyone. Good to have you with us. A shooter shot and killed four U.S. Marines and wounded another, as well as a sailor at two military facilities. All of that happening in the U.S. state of Tennessee. Federal investigators at the FBI say it is premature to speculate on the motives, but a Tennessee state attorney calls the assault an act of terrorism. We get more now from VOA's Carla Babb at the Pentagon.
Four families are suffering now. Four Marines have passed.
That was Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren talking to reporters after a gunman fired dozens of shots into a Marine Corps recruiting station and a Navy operational support center in Chattanooga, Tennessee. A defense official says the gunman was then shot and killed by law enforcement. President Barack Obama asked Americans to pray for the victims' families, adding that an investigation into the attack would be thorough and prompt.
Then we have to make sure that we have all the information necessary to make an assessment in terms of how this attack took place and what further precautions we can take in the future.
Law enforcement sources say the shooter was 24-year-old Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz. An FBI source tells VOA that he was Kuwaiti and was a naturalized U.S. citizen. Colonel Warren said the shooter selected military centers with lighter security.
Well, we have our recruiting centers set up in places easily accessible to the public, for example, you know, a strip mall. So security there is, you know, not like what you would see at a Fort Bragg or at a Norfolk Naval Air Station or at Quantico.
He said the military has made no adjustment to nationwide force protection levels at this time, but was working with law enforcement agencies to determine if any adjustments are needed. A defense official says chatter from terror cells had increased after the Islamic State called for attacks during the Muslim holy month of Ramadan, but that none of the chatter had mentioned military recruiting centers. Ramadan ends on Friday. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
President Obama has become the first sitting U.S. president to visit a federal prison, part of his push to a fairer justice system as well as prison reform. Mr. Obama traveled Thursday to El Reno prison. It's in the state of Oklahoma, where he met with both law enforcement officials and nonviolent drug offenders.
We've got to be able to distinguish between dangerous individuals who need to be incapacitated and incarcerated versus young people who are in an environment in which they are adapting, but if given different opportunities, a different vision of life, could be thriving the way we are.
He also expressed a certain kinship with six inmates he met during that visit to the prison.
These are young people who made mistakes that aren't that different than the mistakes I made and the mistakes that a lot of you guys made. The difference is they did not have the kinds of support structures, the second chances, the resources that would allow them to survive those mistakes.
President Obama also said overly harsh sentences are responsible for the doubling of U.S. prison population over the last 20 years. United States is the world's largest jailer, accounting for nearly 25% of the world's prison population, despite making up less than 5% of the world's population. Also in the news, Greece won a financial lifeline on Thursday from its European neighbors, with Eurozone finance chiefs agreeing to hand Athens a short-term loan to meet its immediate debts and also open talks on a new three-year, $94 billion bailout. The finance ministers took the actions just hours after Greek lawmakers approved tough austerity reforms demanded by Athens' creditors. At the same time, the European Central Bank said it would raise the cap on its emergency funding for Greek banks by $978 million, which may allow them to reopen soon after being closed for 2 weeks. The banks were closed for a fear of a run on deposits as debt-racked Greece feared a financial collapse while negotiating terms of a new austerity for cash deal. We wanted to find out more about all of this, so our VOA's Jeffrey Young asked Peterson Institute for International Economics Senior Fellow Jacob Kierkegaard just what is this bridge loan the EU is giving Greece?
A bridge loan is basically an advance that Greece is getting for a much bigger loan or much bigger bailout that will be negotiated in the coming weeks and months. So this is essentially just a cash advance that allows Greece to pay a number of bills that it have falling due in the coming weeks, including, in fact, to EU institutions like the ECB itself.
Can you explain some of the things that Greece had to do to get the EU to advance this money?
Yes, basically in the last couple of weeks and months, there has an acute trust deficit has emerged between the Greek government and its European partners. So what the Europeans basically told the Greeks is that you have to do a very large amount of the reforms up front in order to get this bridge loans, and that includes things like reforming the pension system. It involves further liberalizing the Greek labor market. It involves signing up for establishment of a new, potentially far-reaching privatization fund so that you can make sure that the Greek government actually carries through the kind of privatization of state assets that it needs. So this was no doubt a politically very, very difficult vote for the Greek government to pass.
As evidenced by the fact that on Wednesday, we saw mass demonstrations in Athens. Apparently, a lot of people were upset.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that this vote in the Greek parliament was a remarkable U-turn for a government that just 2 weeks ago campaigned actively in a public referendum for the Greek people to reject a bailout that was actually less harsh than the one the government now had to pass through parliament. But of course, the big difference that happened in the meantime was that the Europeans basically told the Greeks that unless they did this, they would be outside of the common currency, and that threat clearly worked.
Is there any sort of a timeline if the reforms demanded by the Eurozone are put into place? How long is it going to be before Greece is realistically back on its feet?
There's no doubt that that will take years, but that doesn't change the fact that there's actually significant carrots to Greece in this agreement, because it is for the first time, in my opinion, including what I would call credible offers from the Eurozone to the Greek government of further debt restructuring and indeed debt relief. And that, in my opinion, will come as soon as probably early next year.
VOA's Jeffrey Young was speaking with Jacob Kierkegaard. He is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. And now that we've heard from an expert about this Greece bailout, let's check out what the public's reaction is on the social media. International Edition's G. Abby Lee right here with us now to discuss what people are saying. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. As we just heard from the Peterson Institute Q&A, Athens basically did a 180 from 2 weeks ago. And not surprisingly, many Greek citizens are not at all thrilled about that. So far this week, there are three main hashtags on this topic.
Why don't we start with the latest one?
Sure, it's hashtag agreement, a combination of the words agreement and Greek. That hashtag was used more than 2,600 times during the last 24 hours.
So Grexit, referendum, and now agreement. I'm amazed by the Twitter user's creativity. What's the other hashtag, G?
It's hashtag this is a coup. And that was the second most used hashtag in the world during the last weekend. It was used by commentators lashing out at what they view as an unfair deal for Greece. And because Greece was running out of cash and desperate for a deal, some people feel that the government was forced to negotiate from a position of weakness.
So an obvious question, I think, G, is just how prevalent is that sentiment on the web?
The social media analytics website Topsy shows that the hashtag was used almost 2,000 times during the last 24 hours, and during the last 7 days, it was used in around 470,000 tweets. But recently, that hashtag was replaced by a new one.
And what is it, and how different is it from the previous hashtag?
The replacing hashtag was hashtag Tsipras Leave EU Summit. That was not as popular, maybe because it was so specific, and that hashtag was designed to urge the Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, to step out of the EU summit. Some Twitter users used both hashtags and said, it's not about leaving the Eurozone or not. They argued it's about humiliation or dignity.
Sounds to me like many of these people are taking it quite personally.
Oh, absolutely. And that's because even though these policies are not designed to be taken that way, people do take them personally. I mean, national pride is personal, money is personal, and how these people view the decisions have a real impact on the world economy and diplomacy. Steve?
Many thanks, G. That is VOA's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can stay on top of all the news at our website, voanews.com, and join the conversation about what's happening on Twitter. Our new handle, you got to check it out, is at @VOA_IE. This is VOA.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Top American and British diplomats appear to have made a little headway in Thursday's meetings in an easing of Saudi and Israeli fears about the historic international agreement aimed at keeping Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Here in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with his counterpart, Saudi Foreign Minister Adel Al-Jubeir, whose government has been alarmed by the deal with regional rival Iran. And in Jerusalem, British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond sparred publicly with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about that deal. Mr. Netanyahu called it perplexing that the pact does not address Iran's call to annihilate Israel. Two rights groups say violence affects about 1 billion children every year, and its consequences cost economies $7 trillion annually. The NGOs say while violence against women and children has gained more attention, violence against boys has not. It's a leading cause of death for adolescent boys in many parts of the world. We got more now from VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The groups Without Violence and Together for Girls say violence against children is a major challenge to development. They say that continued exposure to violence, whether as a victim or a witness, has significant detrimental effects on a child's brain. Those effects include post-traumatic stress, leading to social, emotional, and behavioral problems. Lisa Witter is executive director of Without Violence, or, as she describes herself, the group's chief optimist.
Violence against children is an issue that happens all around the world in every country and every income level of a home, and whether the parents are educated or not, violence against children happens everywhere. We've learned in talking about the issue of violence that different people have definitions of what violence against children is. Is it mental abuse, physical abuse? Is it corporal punishment? Is it war? It's all of it. We're really looking at reducing violence in any setting and in any way against children.
Witter says girls are especially vulnerable to sexual violence and child marriage, which she also considers a form of violence.
Girls are much more likely to be married under the age of 18 than boys, and this is a real violent act. It's not under her own will, and they should be girls, not brides.
As for boys,
one in five victims of homicide are children, and boys account for 70% of them. Real harsh violence is really a big issue for boys. Sexual violence, as I said, is a big issue for girls, but 73 million boys under the age of 18 experience sexual violence. So while girls are a higher risk factor for it, it's a boys issue. And then the other issue we think a lot about are child soldiers. There are estimated 250,000 child soldiers in the world, and 90% of them are boys.
She also says that 156 million men alive today were married as children. Witter and Michelle Maloney Kitts, head of Together for Girls, have written an opinion piece in which they say violence is like a transmitted disease, and growing up around violence is the single best predictor that a child will go on to become either a victim or perpetrator of violence as an adult. They say that gender norms make it difficult for boys to admit they are victims of violence. In fact, on average, men who finally disclose they were sexually assaulted do so 22 years after the assault occurred. That's about 10 years later than women. To help boys become less vulnerable to violence, the NGOs recommend parenting programs for caregivers. School-based programs, they say, can teach adolescents about safe dating practices. And mentoring programs have shown success in preventing homicides or joining gangs. The groups want the issue included in the new UN Sustainable Development Goals that will be finalized in September. Witter says life can be better for every child if UN members invest in breaking the cycle of violence.
I care deeply about boys and girls, you know, and I want to reduce violence against girls, and I want to reduce violence against boys. I'm a mother of two young boys, 6 and 8, and this stuff is very personal to me. And we can't stop the cycle of violence unless we focus on boys and girls. And what we want to do is just continue through the UN process and through talking to companies and through talking to communities and help scaling things that we know that work really reduce violence.
In related news, at the third International Conference for Financing for Development in Addis Ababa this week, a global partnership was announced to end violence against children. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Pope Francis has won praise from the political left and from environmentalists for saying that globalization is hurting the poor and contributing to climate change. But conservative Catholics here in the United States say his economic thinking is wrong. VOA's Jerome Sokolowski has our report.
During his recent visit to Bolivia, Pope Francis called the unfettered pursuit of money
el estiércol del diablo,
the dung of the devil.
He blamed it for environmental degradation and said greed has taken over the economic system in a subtle dictatorship. It was seen as a revolutionary call for help for those who have not benefited from globalization. Stephen Schneck of the Catholic University of America in Washington says the Pope's concern comes from his experience as Archbishop of Buenos Aires.
This is a man who is on fire with whatever that inspiration was that he drew from, you know, dealing with the marginalized in Argentina.
Pope Francis believes the free market needs a moral framework, says Schneck.
He's not arguing against the market per se. What he's saying is that the market can't be idolized. In other words, we can't turn the market and its operations into some sort of an idol.
The Pope's supporters say he's not advocating a Marxist solution. But his view is seen as a critique of the United States leadership of the global economy.
Digamos no.
Let us say no to an economy of exclusion and inequality, where money rules rather than service. That economy kills. That economy excludes. That economy destroys Mother Earth.
When the Pope says that this economy kills, that this economy destroys the environment, I'm not quite sure what economy he's talking about.
Former Vatican consultant Kishore Jayabalan says the Pope's view is one-sided. When the Pope suggested globalization was a factor in the migrant crisis in the Mediterranean, he had it backwards, says Jayabalan.
Poor people benefit from being part of this global economy, and the worst thing would be to exclude them and force them to become migrants, which is what's happening today.
On the flight back to Rome, Francis was asked what he thought of such criticism coming mainly from American conservatives. He said he ought to study it before he visits the United States in September. Jerome Sokolovsky, VOA News, Washington.
And we hope you'll stay with us. There is more ahead. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
India is moving aggressively to strengthen its trade relationship with Africa. Their bilateral trade doubled in the past 7 years and will reach nearly $90 billion this year with a focus on information, communication, and technology, or ICT.
It's more about ICT, agribusiness, exports, and manufacturing.
Alex Vines heads the Africa program at Chatham House and says India's approach to investment in Africa is led through the private sector, whereas China, Africa's top trading partner, is led by the state. But there are a lot of Chinese nationals already working in Africa.
On the whole, Indian companies do seem to tend to look for more local content, hire more local people than the Chinese.
Vines says African countries need to find employment for their own people. There's a huge India-Africa summit planned for October with representatives of 54 countries invited to New Delhi. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music, where British singer and five-time Grammy winner Amy Winehouse, who died 4 years ago at the age of 27, is the subject of a new documentary. Tells her story in her own words and those of the people who were around her. International Edition's David Berg spoke with Shauna Renee about the film Amy.
Shauna, this movie is something that gives a... First of all, the director is Asif Kapadia, and he doesn't use any narration. He just uses archival film of Amy Winehouse's life.
Correct. He allows Amy and the people around Amy to tell her story. And there is no narrative there other than what she explains of herself, other than what we see her go through from very young. It starts when she's a very young girl, I think 14 years old, and then it goes all the way up until, you know, her unfortunate demise.
Now, she died from alcohol poisoning.
Yes.
She had a problem with, I think the movie brings this out, she had a problem with an eating disorder. She also had problems with alcohol and drugs.
And drugs, yes.
And, of course, her most famous pop hit was Rehab.
Right.
The more famous she got, the less intimate the movie is. And it's really, it's kind of sad. It's a sad portrayal of somebody who said all she was ever going to be was a singer.
Yeah. And I think it's indicative of life in that realm, the life of a celebrity. The more famous they become, the more sort of internal and alone and lonely they become because they don't know who they can trust.
Mm.
They're not sure whether or not the people who are in their immediate circle can be people that they trust. And she kind of deals with that a little bit. In the footage, she's asked questions about, do you know who you can trust? Do you have people around you who you can trust? Even her husband's, the relationship she had with her husband was called into question. He was said to be enabling her alcoholism,
right,
and maybe to a lesser degree her drug use.
Right.
And that was supposed to be the most intimate relationship that she had.
And there was a relationship, kind of a semi-toxic relationship, with her dad and with her manager. They were both kind of... One thing I've heard about this movie is it shows how the people around her never really talked to one another.
Right.
They talked to her, but they never really talked to one another about her to get her the help that she needed. And it's really sad because she died at 27 years old.
Yeah. And her father is not very happy with this movie. Her father has come out publicly and said that he doesn't believe she would have appreciated the way that she's being portrayed in this movie. And he certainly doesn't appreciate the way he's being portrayed in this movie as someone who had no clue, no concern for what was going on in her life.
Well, the documentary is called Amy, and it opens in wide release here in the United States. United States this week?
This weekend, yes. And one of the interesting things about this from a musical perspective is that now people who may not have been familiar with her music or forgot about it are downloading it. So her albums are seeing a resurgence of popularity. And I just think it's a beautiful thing because she was such a talented musician and singer and songwriter. So at least she gets a second life, if you will.
If you want to send Shauna a message on Twitter, she is at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. We, of course, are at VOA underscore IE.
Yes, Amy Winehouse, also very popular with some older people like me. She did some duets with Tony Bennett, so anyway, you should check out Amy. Other news, General Motors officials met Thursday with leaders of an activist group demanding the automaker cut financial ties with singer Kid Rock over his use of the Confederate battle flag. National Action Network Detroit chapter protested his use of the flag, and the musician's publicist told a newspaper in Detroit that he had last used the flag more than 5 years ago. Flag's use has spurred protests since last month's killing of 9 African-American worshipers at a church in Charleston, South Carolina. White men charged in the slayings had posed with flags and photos that were posted online after the attack that police say was motivated by racial hatred. Flag was removed last week from the South Carolina State House. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Aiden Uku, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Iraqi government has announced it is leading a major military push to retake Iraq's Anbar province from ISIL, which controls two of the province's major cities, Ramadi and Fallujah. Clearing ISIL from Anbar is no easy task. As President Barack Obama recently noted, ISIL has dug in among innocent civilian populations in the urban areas under its control. But as local forces take on ISIL militarily, it is also important for ISIL sympathizers in Iraq, Syria, and beyond to hear the stories of those who were once attracted to the propaganda promulgated by ISIL, but who have come to reject it. As President Obama has said, to ultimately defeat terrorist groups like ISIL, it is necessary to discredit their ideology, the twisted thinking that draws vulnerable people into their ranks. Who can do that better than those who have seen it from the inside at close quarters? Take, for example, a former ISIL fighter from Fallujah known as Hamza, who volunteered to join ISIL last summer, but who defected after 6 months. He told the Independent newspaper he joined the group for religious reasons, but was appalled by the beheadings, by being asked to execute Sunnis whom he knew, and by being offered captured young Yazidi women for sexual pleasure. At the beginning, I thought they were fighting for Allah, but later I discovered they were far from the principles of Islam, he said. The justice they were calling for when they first arrived in Fallujah turned out to be only words. Or the Syrian teenager Youssef Barho, recruited by ISIL to be a suicide bomber, who eventually gave himself up to Iraqi authorities. He told the New York Times last year he joined ISIL willingly because he believed in Islam and had been convinced by ISIL that if he didn't join the group, Shiites would come and rape his mother. Soon, however, he said, I noticed things that were different from Islam. He noted, for example, that ISIL inflicted severe punishments on men in the city who were caught smoking cigarettes. Yet in camp, he saw fighters smoking. He witnessed homosexual encounters between the fighters, and he became increasingly disturbed by the killing of innocent people. President Obama has said that the international fight against ISIL is a battle against terrorists who distort Islam and whose victims are mostly Muslims. Those who have experienced ISIL firsthand and have turned away say the same.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.